This is Audible.
Pushkin Industries presents The Bomber Mafia, A Dream, A Temptation, and the Longest Night of the Second World War. Written and read by Malcolm Gladwell.
Hello, dear listener. This is Malcolm Gladwell. Before we begin, I want to point you towards a special treat that will enhance your listening experience. Head to bombermafia.com/bonus and sign up to receive a listener's guide, including photos and other commentary to enrich your experience of the Bomber Mafia. When you sign up with your email, you'll also hear first about all of the immersive audiobooks coming from my company, Pushkin Industries. We've got some really fun stuff in store. Again, that's bombermafia.com/bonus to receive the free listener's guide. Thank you for your interest and time. And now, on to the book. The Bomber Mafia is dedicated to Kamo and B. Kamo. As a little boy lying in his bed, my father would hear the planes overhead on their way in, then in the small hours of the morning, heading back to Germany. This was in England, in Kent, a few miles south and east of London. My father was born in 1934, which meant he was five when the Second World War broke out. Kent was called Bomb Alley by the British because it was the English county that German warplanes would fly over on their way to London. It was not uncommon in those years that if a bomber missed its target or had bombs left over, it would simply drop them anywhere on the return trip. One day, a stray bomb landed in my grandparents' back garden. It didn't explode. It just sat there, half buried in the ground. And I think it's fair to say that if you were a five-year-old boy with an interest in things mechanical, a German bomb sitting unexploded in your backyard would have been just about the most extraordinary experience imaginable. Not that my father described it that way. My dad was a mathematician and an Englishman, which is to say that the language of emotion was not his first language. Rather, it was like Latin or French, something which one could study and understand, but never fully master. No, that an unexploded German bomb in your backyard would be the most extraordinary experience imaginable for a five-year-old was my interpretation when my father told me that story of the bomb when I was 5 years old. That was in the late 1960s. We were living in England then, in Southampton. Reminders of what the country had gone through were still everywhere. If you went to London, you could still tell where the bombs had landed, wherever a hideous, brutalist building had sprouted up on some centuries-old block.
Here they come. They come in absolute steep dive, and you can see their bombs actually leave the machines and come into the water. You can hear our own guns going like anything now.
BBC Radio was always on in our house, and in those days, it seemed like every second interview was with an old general, a paratrooper, a prisoner of war.
We shall prove ourselves once again able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war.
The first short story I wrote as a kid was about how Hitler was actually still alive and coming for England again. I sent it to my grandmother, the one in Kent who'd had the unexploded bomb in the back garden. When my mother heard about my story, she admonished me. Someone who lived through the war might not enjoy a plot line about Hitler's return, she reminded me. My father once took me and my brothers to a beach overlooking the English Channel. We crawled together through the remnants of an old World War II fortification. I still remember the thrill of wondering if we would come across some old bullets, or a shell casing, or even the skeleton of some long-lost German spy who'd washed up on shore. I don't think we lose our childhood fascinations. I know I didn't. One day, a few years back, I was looking at my bookshelves and realized, to my surprise, just how many non-fiction books about war I had accumulated. The big history bestsellers, but also the specialty histories. Out-of-print memoirs, academic texts. And what part of the war were most of these books about? Bombing. Air Power by Stephen Budiansky. Rhetoric and Reality in Air Warfare by Tammy Biddle. Decision Over Schweinfurt by Thomas Coffey. Whole shelves of these histories. Usually, when I start accumulating books like that, it's because I want to write something about the subject. I have shelves of books on social psychology because I've made my living writing about social psychology. But I never really wrote much about war, especially not the Second World War, or more specifically, Air Power. Just bits and pieces, here and there. Why? I don't know. I imagine that a Freudian would have fun with that question. But maybe the simpler answer is that the more a subject matters to you, the harder it is to find a story you want to tell about it. The bar is higher. Which brings us to The Bomber Mafia, the audiobook you are listening to now. I'm happy to say that with The Bomber Mafia, I've found a story worthy of my obsession. One last thing about the use of that last word, obsession. This book is a service to my obsessions, but it's also a story about other people's obsessions, about one of the grandest obsessions of the 20th century. I realize when I look at the things I've written about or explored over the years that I'm drawn again and again to obsessives. I like them. I like the idea that someone could push away all the concerns and details that make up everyday life and just zero in on one thing, the thing that fits the contours of their imagination. Obsessives lead us astray sometimes, lack the bigger picture, serve not just the world's but their own narrow interests. But I also don't think we get progress or innovation or joy or beauty without obsessives. When I was reporting this book, I had dinner with the then Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force, David Goldfein. It was at the Air House, on the grounds of Fort Myer in Northern Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C., a Grand Victorian on a street of Grand Victorians, where many of the country's top military brass all live. After dinner, General Goldfein invited over a group of his friends and colleagues, other senior Air Force officials. We sat in the general's backyard, five of us in total. They were almost all former military pilots. Many of their fathers had been military pilots. They were the modern-day equivalents of the people you're going to hear about in this book. And as the evening wore on, I began to notice something. Air House is just down the road from Reagan National Airport, and every 10 minutes or so, a plane would take off just over our heads. Nothing fancy, just standard commercial passenger planes, flying to Chicago or Tampa or Charlotte. And every time one of those planes flew overhead, the general and his comrades would all glance upwards just to take a look. They couldn't help themselves. Obsessives. My kind of people. Pushkin Industries presents The Bomber Mafia, A Dream, A Temptation, and The Longest Night of the Second World War. Prologue. This isn't working. You're out. There was a time when the world's largest airport sat in the middle of the Western Pacific, about 1,500 miles from the coast of Japan. On one of a cluster of small tropical islands known as the Marianas, Guam, Saipan, Tinian. The Marianas are at the southern end of a largely submerged mountain range, the tips of old volcanoes poking up through the deep ocean waters. For most of their history, the Marianas were too small to be of much interest or use to anyone in the wider world, until the age of air power, when all of a sudden, they took on enormous importance. The Marianas were in Japanese hands for most of the Second World War, but after a brutal campaign, they fell to the U.S. military in the summer of 1944. Saipan was first in July, then Tinian and Guam in August. When the Marines landed, the Seabees, the Navy's construction battalion, landed with them and set to work. In just 3 months, an entire airbase, Isley Field, was fully operational on Saipan. Then, on the island of Tinian, the largest airport in the world, Northfield, 8,500-foot runways, four of them. And following that, on Guam, what is now Anderson Air Force Base, the U.S. Air Force's gateway to the Far East. Then came the planes.
She was the B-29, the Superfort, with 2,200 horsepower in each of four engines, with a fuel capacity equal to that of a railroad tank car, a tail that climbed two stories into the air, a body longer than a Corvette.
If that voice sounds familiar, it's because it's Ronald Reagan. During the Second World War, he narrated war films.
Designed to carry more destruction and carry it higher, faster, farther than any bomber ever built before. And to complete this mission, that's exactly what she was going to have to do.
The B-29 could fly faster and higher than any other bomber in the world, and more crucially, further than any other bomber. And that extended range meant that for the first time since the war in the Pacific began, the U.S. Army's air forces were within striking distance of Japan. A special unit was created to handle the fleet of bombers now parked in the Marianas, the 21st Bomber Command, under the leadership of a brilliant young general named Haywood Hansel.
Well, the first element of the 21st Bomber Command has arrived.
That's Hansel.
When we've done some more fighting, we'll do some more talking. Thank you.
Throughout the fall and winter of 1944, Hansel launched attack after attack. Hundreds of B-29s skimmed over the Pacific waters, dropped their payloads on Japan, then turned back for the Marianas. As Hansel's airmen prepared to launch themselves at Tokyo, reporters and camera crews flew in from the mainland, recording the excitement for the folks back home.
B-29s on Saipan were like artillery pointed at the heart of Japan. Each Superfort carried well over 7,000 gallons of gas, more than 6,000 rounds of ammunition. With their great load of 500-pound general-purpose bombs and incendiaries, they weighed almost 70 tons apiece.
On the 6th of January, 1945, Hansel's commanding officer, General Loris Norstad, arrived in the Marianas. It was an endless trip, Washington, D.C. to Chicago, Chicago to Sacramento, Sacramento to Honolulu, Honolulu to Guam. Things were still pretty primitive on Guam. Headquarters were just a bunch of metal Quonset huts on a bluff overlooking the ocean. Both men would have been exhausted, not just from the privations of the moment, but from the weight of their responsibility. I once read a passage by the British Air Force General Arthur Harris about what it meant to be an air commander in the Second World War. After I read it, I never forgot it. Harris wrote, "I wonder if the frightful mental strain of commanding a large air force in war can ever be realized except by the very few who have experienced it. While a naval commander may at the most be required to conduct a major action once or twice in the whole course of the war, and an army commander is engaged in one battle, say, once in 6 months, or in exceptional circumstances, as often as once a month, the commander of a bomber force has to commit the whole of it every 24 hours. Harris goes on in that vein, and then he says, "It is best to leave to the imagination what such a daily strain amounts to when continued over a period of years." So there they were in Guam, two war-weary airmen, facing what they hoped might be the war's final chapter. Hansel suggested a quick tour, stand on the beach, admire the brand new runways cut from the jungle, chat about tactics, plans, whiskey, cigars, gossip. Norstedt said no. He had something more personal to discuss. And in a moment that would stay with Heywood Hansel for the rest of his life, Norstedt turned to him and said simply, "This isn't working. You're out." "I thought the earth had fallen in. I was completely crushed." That's how Hansel described his feelings in that moment, years later. Then Norstedt delivered the second, deeper blow. He said, "I'm replacing you with Curtis LeMay." General Curtis Emerson LeMay, 38 years of age, hero of the bombing campaigns over Germany, one of the most storied airmen of his generation. Hansel knew him well. They had served together in Europe, and Hansel understood immediately that this was not a standard leadership reshuffle. This was a rebuke, an about-face, an admission by Washington that everything Hansel had been doing was now considered wrong. Because Curtis LeMay was Heywood Hansel's antithesis. Norstedt said to Hansel, "You can stay on if you like and be LeMay's deputy," which Hansel considered so insulting he could barely speak. He said, "I won't." Norstedt said, "Okay, you have 10 days to finish up." Hansel walked around in a daze. On his last night in Guam, Hansel had a little bit more to drink than normal and sang to his men while a young colonel played the guitar. "Old pilots never die. They just fly away." Curtis LeMay arrived for the changeover, flying himself to the island in a B-29 bomber. The Star Spangled Banner was played. The soldiers of the 21st Command marched by for review. A public relations officer proposed a picture of the two of them to mark the moment. LeMay had a pipe in his mouth. He always had a pipe in his mouth, and he didn't know what to do with it. He kept trying to put it in his pocket. "General," the aide said, "please let me hold your pipe while the picture is taken." LeMay said, in a quiet voice, "Where do you want me to stand?" The cameras clicked. Hansel squinting off in the distance, LeMay looking down at the ground, two men anxious to be anywhere but in each other's company. And with that, it was over. The Bomber Mafia is the story of that moment, what led up to it, and what happened next, because that change of command reverberates to this day. There is something that has always puzzled me about technological revolutions. Some new idea or innovation comes along, and it's obvious to all that it will upend our world. The internet, social media. In previous generations, it was the telephone or the automobile. There's an expectation that because of this new invention, things will get better, more efficient, safer, richer, faster, which they do in some respects. But then things also invariably go sideways. At one moment, social media is being hailed as something that will allow ordinary citizens to upend tyranny. And then, in the next moment, social media is feared as the platform that will allow citizens to tyrannize each other. The automobile was supposed to bring freedom and mobility, which it did for a while. But then millions of people found themselves living miles from their workplace, trapped in endless traffic jams on epic commutes. How is it that sometimes, for any number of unexpected and random reasons, technology slips away from its intended path. The Bomber Mafia is a case study in how dreams go awry, and how, when some new shiny idea drops down from the heavens, it does not land softly in our laps. It lands hard on the ground and shatters. The story I'm about to tell is not really a war story, although it mostly takes place in wartime. It's about a Dutch genius and his homemade computer, a band of brothers in central Alabama, a British psychopath, pyromaniacal chemists in a basement lab at Harvard. It's a story about the messiness of our intentions. Because when we look back, we always forget the mess. And at the heart of the story are Haywood Hansel and Curtis LeMay, who squared off in the jungles of Guam. One was sent home, one stayed on, with a result that would lead to the darkest night of the Second World War. Listen to their story and ask yourself, what would I have done? What side would I have been on? Part 1. The Dream. Chapter 1. Mr. Norden was content to pass his time in the shop. Back when the war that would consume the world was a worry, but not yet a fact, a remarkable man came to the attention of the U.S. military. His name was Carl L. Norden. During his life, Norden shunned the limelight. He worked alone, sometimes returning to Europe during crucial periods to tinker and dream at his mother's kitchen table. He built a business with hundreds of employees. Then, when the war was over, he left it all behind. There are no full-length biographies of Norden, no profile pieces, no statues in his honor, not in his native Holland, not in Switzerland, where he lived out his days, and not in downtown Manhattan, where he did his most important work. Norden influenced the course of a war and sparked a dream that would last the remainder of the century. It does not seem possible that someone could have left as much of a mark on his world as Norden did, and then disappear from sight. Yet he did. In one 352-page technical book on Norden's invention, there is a single sentence devoted to him. Quote, Mr. Norden was content to pass his time in the shop, which sometimes was an 18-hour day. Unquote. That's it. So before we start in on Norden's dream and its consequences, the effect Norden would have on an entire generation. Let us start with Norden himself. I mean, first of all, doesn't seem like there's a lot of documentary record on Norden. He's a very elusive figure.
Right, and it was primarily because he demanded absolute secrecy.
I'm talking with Stephen McFarland, one of the few, and maybe the only, historian who's really dug into the story of Carl Norden. So describe Norden to us.
Well, you know, he was extremely prickly. His ego was greater than any person I've never met. And I said never met because, of course, I never met Norden.
Norden was Dutch. He was born in what is now Indonesia, then a Dutch colony. He spent 3 years apprenticing in a Swiss machine shop, then got an engineering degree from the prestigious Zurich Federal Polytechnic, where one of his classmates was Vladimir Lenin. Norden was trim, dapper, three-piece suit, pipe, short white hair with a little cowlick, thriving mustache. heavy-lidded eyes, underwritten with deep lines, as if he hadn't slept in years. His nickname was Old Man Dynamite. He drank coffee by the gallon, lived on steak.
He truly believed, in a very biological sense, that sun created stupidity. And so you would never see him outside without a big hat on. His family always was forced to wear hats outside. Here they were stationed, as a young boy stationed in the Dutch East Indies. And yet he and his family always wore hats because the sun caused stupidity.
MacFarlane says Norden read Dickens avidly for revelations on the lives of the disadvantaged and Thoreau for the discussion of the simple life. He hated paying taxes. He thought Franklin Roosevelt was the devil.
He's a little cranky.
Quite clearly. There's a famous story where a technician was looking over a technician's shoulder, and the technician got a little bit nervous and trying to strike up a conversation, looked at him and said, perhaps you could explain why we're making this part this way. And Norden screamed at the top of his lungs at him after he yanked the cigar out of his mouth and said, "There's 100,000 reasons why I designed that part that way, and none of it's your damn business." So that's how he treated all his employees. He was truly Old Man Dynamite. But he was an absolute perfectionist, Malcolm, absolute perfectionist. There was absolutely nothing he wouldn't do to make the most perfect. There was no expense, didn't matter. It was make it as perfect as possible. I'd seen a little bit how engineers know what they know and how they do what they do. But all of them talked about the importance of studying what had been done before. Norden's attitude was, "I don't want to hear about it." All he wanted was blank sheets of paper, a pencil, and a couple of engineering books that were filled with formulas about how to calculate certain mathematical problems. He was a true believer in blank slate. And he said very, very, again, I think this reveals his ego. He said, "I don't want to know the mistakes other people made. I don't want to know what they did right. I'm going to develop what's right myself."
What was Carl Norden developing on his blank sheets of paper? A bomb sight. A bomb sight is not something that anyone uses anymore, not in the age of radar and GPS. But for the better part of the last century, bomb sights were matters of great importance. Let me go further, because there is a real risk here of understatement. If you were to have made a list in, say, the early years of the 20th century of the 10 biggest unsolved technological problems of the next half century, what would have been on that list? Well, some things are obvious. Vaccines were desperately needed to prevent childhood diseases, measles, mumps. Better agricultural fertilizers were needed to help prevent famine. Huge parts of the world could be made more productive with affordable, convenient air conditioning. A car cheap enough that a working-class family could own one. I could go on. But somewhere in that list would be a military question. Namely, is there a more accurate way to drop a bomb from an airplane? Now, why does that problem belong on the same list as vaccines and fertilizers and air conditioning? Because early in the 20th century, the world went through World War I, in which 37 million people were wounded or killed. 37 million. A million soldiers died in just one battle, the Battle of the Somme. A million young men dead in a single battle that had no discernible point or conclusion or impact on the course of the war. For those who lived through it, World War I was a deeply traumatic experience. Decades later, veterans of that war could still remember the abject terror that gripped their fellow soldiers. Listen to an oral history taken in 1975 from a man named Donald Wilson. I have to warn you, it's graphic.
One fellow killed himself and chose our mess hall as the place to do it, put his mouth over the muzzle of his rifle and pulled the trigger. And another man, while we were in the trenches, shot himself in the leg. So those people must have magnified their ideas of the great danger But I think, by and large, the most of us just didn't realize what we were getting into.
It was horrific. So what could be done to change things? A small group of people came to believe that the only realistic solution was for armies to change the way they fought wars. To learn to fight, if this doesn't sound like too much of an oxymoron, better wars. And the people who made the argument for better wars were pilots, airmen, people obsessed with one of the newest and most exciting technological achievements of that era, the airplane. Airplanes made their first big appearance in World War I. I'm sure you've seen pictures of what those early planes looked like. Plywood, fabric, metal, and rubber. Two wings, upper and lower, connected by struts. One seat. A machine gun facing forward, synchronized to fire through the propeller. They resembled something that came in the mail to be assembled in a garage. The most famous of World War I fighter planes was a Sopwith Camel. That's the one Snoopy flew in the old Peanuts comic strip. It was a mess. In the hands of a novice, the aviation writer Robert Jackson says, it displayed vicious characteristics that could make it a killer, meaning a killer of the pilot flying it, not the enemy under attack. But a new generation of pilots looked at these contraptions and said, something like this can make all of that deadly, wasteful, pointless conflict on the ground obsolete. What if we just fought wars from the air? One of those airmen was Donald Wilson, the soldier who witnessed some of the horrors of the First World War. Wilson started flying in the 1920s and ended up as a general in the Second World War. I ran across a memoir Wilson self-published after his retirement. It looks like a high school yearbook. Goes on forever. And right in the middle, Wilson has this strangely riveting passage. Don't worry so much about what he's saying. I just want you to focus on the language he's using. This is what he writes of the conclusion he came to in his first years of flying. Then, out of nowhere, a vision evolved. As in later years, in an entirely different context, Martin Luther King said in a moving speech, "I have a dream." Wilson is comparing his vision of the promise of air power to the most iconic moment in the civil rights movement. And then he borrows King's rhetorical pattern as well. I had a dream that nations fought each other in order to dictate terms and not to prove supremacy of arms as military tradition insisted. I had a dream that important nations, the likely adversaries, were industrialized and dependent upon smooth operations of organized and mutually sustaining elements. I had a dream that the new and coming air capability could destroy a limited number of targets within this web of interdependent features of the modern nation. I had a dream that such destruction and the possibility of more of the same would cause the victim to sue for peace. That means he believed that planes could win wars all by themselves. They could swoop down and bomb select targets and bring the enemy to its knees without the slaughter of millions on a battlefield. In every way, this passage is audacious. There were so few military pilots in the United States back in those days that they all knew each other. It was like a club, a band of zealots. And Wilson says this tiny club, with its ramshackle flying machines, could reinvent war. But before the dream could be made real, the airmen knew they had to deal with a problem. If you thought, as the dreamers did, that the airplane could revolutionize warfare, could swoop down and bomb select targets and bring the enemy to its knees, then you had to have a way to hit those select targets. And no one knew how to do that. Let's start with, for a layperson, describe why the task of dropping a bomb from an airplane is difficult. I mean, the dumbest possible question. Let's start with that one.
Okay. I don't consider it dumb at all. It's amazing to me. I mean, I just assumed, you know, that you watch the videos and the movies and they say, just put the crosshairs on the target and the bomb sight will do the rest. But there's an amazing number of elements that come into dropping a bomb accurately on a target. I think, you know, if you think about your own car, you know, driving down the highway at 60, 70 miles an hour, you can imagine throwing out something out the window and trying to hit something, you know, even if it's stationary, like a sign or a tree or anything on the side of the road. You get an idea of just how hard that is.
If you're trying to throw a bottle into a garbage can from a car going 50 miles per hour, you have to perform a bit of amateur physics. The garbage can is stationary, but you and the car are moving quickly, so you have to release the bottle well before you reach the can, right? But if you're in an airplane at 20,000 feet, the problem is infinitely more complicated.
Aircraft were flying at 200, 300 miles an hour, sometimes as fast as 500 miles an hour. They were dropping bombs from up to 30,000 feet that would take between 20 and 30, 35 seconds to hit the ground. And during that whole time, you're being shot at. You're having to look through clouds or not be able to look through clouds. Anti-aircraft artillery, you're having to deal with factory decoys, smoke screens. There's the smoke from other bombs, people screaming in your ear, the excitement. That all these strange things that happen once war begins, and get some idea of just how difficult it is.
The wind could be blowing at 100 miles per hour. You have to factor that in. If it's cold, the air is denser, and the bomb will fall more slowly. If it's warm, the air is thinner, and the bomb will fall faster. Then you also have to consider, is the plane level? Is it moving side to side or up and down? A tiny degree of error at the release point can translate to a big error on the ground. And from 20,000 feet, can you even see the target? A factory might be big and obvious up close, but from that far up, it looks like a postage stamp. Bombers in the early days of aviation couldn't hit anything, not even close. The bombardiers might as well have been throwing darts at a dartboard with their eyes closed. The dream that the airplane could revolutionize warfare was based on a massive, untested, unproven assumption that somehow someone at some point would figure out how to aim a bomb from high in the sky with something close to accuracy. It was a question on the era's technological wish list. Until Carl Norden.
He had no help. He did it all by himself. It was all in his mind. He didn't carry notes. He didn't have a notepad. You can't, you know, go to his archive, there is no such thing. It was all kept in his head. And for a man to keep that kind of complexity in his head, I was just amazed that it could be done that way. But engineers refer to something called the mind's eye, that they see things in their mind, not with their eyes, but with their mind's eye. And that was truly Carl Norden.
I always dislike using the word genius because I feel like it's thrown around. And I always prefer to kind of put an adjective in front of the word genius. What's his adjective?
He would tell you that only God invents, humans discover. So for him, it was not genius. He would have refused to accept that term. He would not appreciate, would not accept anyone calling him a genius. He would say he's just one who discovers the greatness of God, is what he would tell you. That God reveals truths through people who are willing to work hard and to use their minds to discover God's truths.
Norden began working on the bombsight problem in the 1920s. He got a Navy contract, although he would later work for the Army's Air Corps, which is what the U.S. Air Force was called in those days. He set up shop on Lafayette Street in the part of Manhattan now called Soho, and there he began work on his masterpiece.
These gentlemen are aerial photographs of enemy-held objectives. They are our targets for tomorrow and the next day and the next. One of them may be your target.
You're listening to an internal military training film from the Second World War, instructing bombardiers in how to use Carl Norden's creation, the Norden bombsight.
They are the reason for your being here. The reason for all the vast equipment assembled in this and other bombardier schools. For the instructors here to train you. For the pilots here to fly you on your missions.
The bombers that flew in the Second World War, in most cases, had a crew of 10 men, pilot, co-pilot, navigator, gunners, and most crucially, bombardiers, the people who aimed and dropped the bombs. If the bombardier did not do his job, then the efforts of all nine of his crewmen were wasted.
In all likelihood, some one of you now sitting in this room will see one of these targets, not projected on a screen, but moving under the crosshair of your bomb sight. And where will they fall, those bombs of yours? That will depend on how well you'll have taught your fingers and your eyes to match the precision that has been built into your Norden bomb sight.
Its official name was the Mark 15. The airman who used it called it the football. It weighed 55 pounds. It sat on a kind of platform, a packing box stabilized by a gyroscope that kept it level at all times, even as the plane was bouncing around. The bomb sight was essentially an analog computer, a compact, finely machined contraption composed of mirrors, a telescope, ball bearings, levels, and dials. The bombardier peered through the telescope at the target from a moving plane and made a fantastically complicated series of adjustments. Norden created 64 algorithms that he believed represented every dimension of the bombing problem. Like, for example, how much does the speed and direction of the wind affect the trajectory of a bomb? Or the temperature? Or the speed of the aircraft?
Now look at the line in the flooring. That was your sighting line when you started. Remember how the sight's made in two parts? Underneath, there's the stabilizer. And in that, there's another gyro, only it has a horizontal axis.
To be properly trained on the Norden took 6 months.
Above that is your sight. The stabilizer is fixed in the longitudinal axis of the airplane. But you can keep turning the sight so that it's always pointing at the target. But the sight is also connected to the stabilizer by rods.
Bombardier to pilot. Okay to level, sir.
By these, the gyro controls the position of the sight so that no matter how much the airplane yaws, the sight will always point in the same direction.
Level. Level. Bombs away.
All this so the bombardier could know exactly when to shout, "Bombs away!"
In addition, Norden even created one of his 64 algorithms was an algorithm that compensated for the fact that when you drop a bomb and it takes 30 seconds to hit the target, during those 30 seconds, the Earth actually moves. It spins on its axis. So he actually created a formula that if it was going to take 20 seconds for the bomb to hit the target, then the Earth would move, I'm going to make up a number, 12 feet. You therefore had to adjust the computer to say, well, the target's now moved 12 feet. If you're at 20,000 feet, it might move 25 feet. And all of these then had to be put into this computer.
Eventually, almost every bomber that flew missions for the United States over Europe and Japan during the Second World War had a Norden bomb sight on board. The Army bought thousands of them. Before every mission, the bombardier would retrieve his device from a vault with an armed escort, carry it out to the plane in a metal box. In the event of a crash landing, the bombardier was instructed to destroy the bomb sight immediately, lest it fall into enemy hands. Legend has it that bombardiers were even given an 18-inch-long explosive device to do the trick. And, as a final precaution, the bombardier had to take a special oath. I solemnly swear that I will keep inviolate the secrecy of any and all confidential information revealed to me, and in full knowledge that I am a guardian of one of my country's most priceless assets, do further swear to protect the secrecy of the American bombsight, if need be, with my life itself. In the midst of all this drama and secrecy was Carl Norden, maddening, eccentric Norden. While he was still perfecting his invention, he would sometimes leave Manhattan and return to his mother's house in Zurich. It would drive the military crazy.
The Army was just up in arms. The FBI sent agents with him to try to protect him. There was a great fear that the British supposedly thought that he was working for the Germans as a spy, and they were afraid the British would try to capture him. And so but he absolutely insisted. He said, "I'm going to Switzerland. There's nothing you can do to stop me." And, of course, the laws of wartime were not yet in effect because the United States wasn't in the war, so that legally there was no way they could stop him.
So why did the military put up with him? Because the Norden bomb sight was the Holy Grail. Norden had a business partner named Ted Barth. He was the salesman, the public face, and he claimed the year before the U.S. joined the war that we do not regard a 15-foot square as being a very difficult target to hit from an altitude of 30,000 feet. The shorthand version of that, which would serve as the foundation of the Norden legend, was that the bomb site could drop a bomb into a pickle barrel from 6 miles up. To the first generation of military pilots, that claim was intoxicating. The most expensive single undertaking of the Second World War was the B-29 bomber, the Superfortress. The second most expensive was the massive, unprecedented effort to invent and build the world's first atomic bomb, the Manhattan Project. But the third most expensive project of the war? Not a bomb, not a plane, not a tank, not a gun, not a ship. No, the Norden bombsight. The 55-pound analog computer conceived inside the exacting imagination of Carl L. Norden. And why spend so much on a bombsite? Because the Norden represented a dream. One of the most powerful dreams in the history of warfare. That if we could drop bombs inside pickle barrels from 30,000 feet, we wouldn't need armies anymore. We wouldn't need to leave young men dead on battlefields or lay waste to entire cities. We could reinvent war, make it precise and quick and almost bloodless. Almost.
Pretty good, huh? In fact, terrific.
Chapter 2. We make progress unhindered by custom. Revolutions are invariably group activities. That's why Carl Norden was such an anomaly. Rarely does someone start a revolution alone at their mother's kitchen table. The Impressionist movement didn't begin because one genius took up painting that way and, like the Pied Piper, attracted a trail of followers. No. Pissarro and Degas enrolled at the École des Beaux-Arts at the same time. Then Pissarro met Monet and later Cézanne at the Académie Suisse. Manet met Degas at the Louvre. Monet befriended Renoir at Charles Glare's studio. And Renoir, in turn, met Pissarro and Cézanne. And soon enough, everyone was hanging out at the Café Gerbois, trading ideas and egging each other on, and sharing and competing and dreaming all together until something radical and entirely new emerged. This happens all the time. Gloria Steinem was the most famous face of the feminist movement in the early 1970s. But what was it that led to a doubling of the number of women elected to office in the United States? Gloria Steinem plus Shirley Chisholm, Bella Abzug, and Tanya Milish coming together to create the National Women's Political Caucus. Revolutions are birthed in conversation. Argument, validation, proximity, and the look in your listener's eye that tells you you're on to something. For those caught up in the dream of changing modern warfare, that place where friends spent time with each other and had long arguments into the night and saw that look in each other's eyes was an airbase called Maxwell Field. Maxwell Field was, and is, in Montgomery, Alabama. It was an old cotton plantation, converted to an airfield by the Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur. In the 1930s, it became home to something called the Air Corps Tactical School, the aviation version of the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, or the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. Much of the base today remains the same as it was when it was built in the 1930s. Everything is in pale yellow concrete or stucco with red tile roofs. There are hundreds of elegant houses for the officers, built in the French provincial style on quiet, curving streets, lined with giant ring-cup oak trees.
In the summer, the air is thick and wet. This is deep inside Alabama. The grand 19th century buildings that make up the Alabama State House are just down the road, a few miles away. It does not feel like the birthplace of a revolution, but it was. In those years, the Air Force was not a separate branch of the military. It was a combat division of the Army. It existed to serve the interests of the ground forces, to support, assist, accompany. The legendary Army General John Blackjack Pershing, who commanded the American forces in World War I, once said of air power that it, quote, can of its own account neither win a war at the present time nor, so far as we can tell, at any time in the future. That's what the military establishment thought of airplanes.
It was a constant controversy.
This is Richard Cohn. For a decade, he was the chief historian of the U.S. Air Force.
I remember one congressman being quoted as saying, why do we have all this controversy over airplanes? Why don't we just buy one of them and let the services share it?
The very first site for the Air Corps Tactical School was not in Alabama, but in Langley, Virginia. There were stables out by the airplane hangars, and pilots were expected to learn how to ride as if it were still the 19th century. Can you imagine how the Army's pilots of that era, and there were only a few hundred of them, felt about that? So long as they were part of the Army, they came to believe, they would be under the command of people who couldn't fly airplanes, didn't understand airplanes, and wanted them to rub down the horses every morning. The pilots wanted to be independent. And the first step towards independence was to move their training school as far as humanly possible, physically and culturally, from the influence of the Army. The fact that Maxwell Field was on an old cotton plantation in a sleepy corner of the South was, to use the modern expression, a feature and not a bug. Because air power was young, the faculty of the tactical school were young, in their 20s and 30s, full of the ambition of youth. They got drunk on the weekends, flew warplanes for fun, and raced each other in their cars. Their motto was proficimus more irritanti. We make progress unhindered by custom. The leaders of the Air Corps Tactical School were labeled the Bomber Mafia. It was not intended as a compliment. These were the days of Al Capone and Lucky Luciano and shootouts on the street. But the Air Corps faculty, they thought the outcast label quite suited them. And it stuck.
We were highly enthusiastic. We were starting on like a crusade something. There were a dozen of us, and the only opposition we had were the 10,000 officers in the rest of the Army, plus the Navy.
That's Harold George, one of the spiritual leaders of the Bomber Mafia. George was from Boston, joined the Army during the First World War, became captivated by airplanes, started teaching at the tactical school in the early 1930s, rose to the rank of general during the Second World War. After the war, he went to work for Howard Hughes, setting up Hughes's electronics business. Then George left to help build another electronics firm that became a giant defense contractor. And this is my favorite part. He was twice elected mayor of Beverly Hills. Oh, and I forgot to mention, looks like a movie star. That's one man in one lifetime. But if you had asked Harold George what was the highlight of his career, he probably would have said those heady days in the 1930s teaching at Maxwell Field.
I must admit one thing, however. Nobody seemed to understand what we were doing, and therefore we got no directives that we were to stop the kind of instruction that we were giving.
The tactical school was a university, an academy, but not many of the faculty had any experience teaching. And the things they were teaching were so new and radical that there weren't really any textbooks for anyone to study or articles for anyone to read. So they mostly made things up on the fly, so to speak. Lectures quickly turned into seminars, which turned into open discussions,
which spilled out into dinner in the evening. That's what always happens. All this conversation plants the seeds of a revolution. The group starts to wander off in directions that no one individual could ever have conceived of going all by himself or herself. Donald Wilson was another of the Bomber Mafia inner circle. He was the one who later wrote in his memoirs about how he had a dream of a different kind of war.
I feel quite certain that if the controlling element of the War Department General Staff had known what we were doing at Maxwell Field, that we would have all been put in jail, because it was so contrary to their established doctrine that I just can't imagine their knowing and allowing us to do it.
When people thought about military aircraft in the first part of the 20th century, they thought of fighter planes, small and highly maneuverable airplanes that could engage the enemy in the air, but not the Renegades at Maxwell Field. They were obsessed by the technological advances in aviation that happened during the 1930s. Aluminum and steel replaced plywood. Engines got more powerful. Planes got bigger and easier to fly. They had retractable landing gear and pressurized fuselages. And those advances allowed the Bomber Mafia to imagine an entirely new class of airplane, something as large as the commercial airliners that had just started ferrying passengers across the United States. A plane that big and powerful wouldn't be limited to fighting other planes in the sky. It could carry bombs, heavy, powerful explosives that could do significant damage to the enemy's positions on the ground. Now, why would that be so devastating? Because if you put one of these newly powerful engines inside one of these newly massive airplanes, that plane could fly so far and so fast for so long that nothing could stop it. Anti-aircraft guns, please. Those would be like pea shooters. Enemy fighters, small annoying gnats buzzing harmlessly. This kind of airplane could have armor plating, guns at the back and front to defend itself. And so we arrive at principle number one of the Bomber Mafia doctrine. The bomber will always get through. Second tenet. Up until then, it was assumed that the only way to bomb your enemy was in the safety of darkness. But if the bomber was unstoppable, why would stealth matter? The Bomber Mafia wanted to attack by daylight. Third tenet. If you could bomb by daylight, then you could see whatever it was you were trying to hit. You weren't blind anymore. And if you could see, it meant that you could use a bomb sight, line up the target, enter the necessary variables, let the device do its work, and boom. Fourth and final tenet. Conventional wisdom said that when a bomber approached its target, it had to come down as close as it could to the ground in order to aim properly. But if you had the bomb sight, you could drop your bomb from way up high, outside the range of anti-aircraft guns. We can put a bomb inside a pickle barrel at 30,000 feet. High altitude, daylight, precision bombing. That was what the Bomber Mafia cooked up in their hideaway in central Alabama.
It was collegial. It was, I would call it almost to the point of Band of Brothers. But if you didn't buy the doctrine, and some of them didn't, you could be, how does one put that? Not exactly expelled from the brotherhood, but suspected and opposed.
This is Richard Cohn again. And what does he mean by expelled from the brotherhood? There was a pilot on the tactical school staff named Claire Chenault who dared to challenge the Bomber Mafia orthodoxy. They ran him out of town.
They were a rebellious bunch. They engaged in public relations campaigns. Some of them wrote under pseudonyms to promote air power. They were promoting it, and they were promoting it in ways they knew that could get them into real trouble as military officers.
I didn't really grasp the audacity of the Bomber Mafia's vision until I went to Maxwell. It's now Maxwell Air Force Base, not Maxwell Field. It's home to the Air Force University, the successor to the Air Corps Tactical School. People come from around the world to study there. The faculty include many of the country's leading military historians and tacticians and strategists. And I sat one afternoon with a group of Maxwell faculty in a conference room just a stone's throw from where the Bomber Mafia held forth almost a century ago. All of the records from the original tactical school are in the Maxwell archives, and the historians I spoke to had been to the Bomber Mafia's old field notes and lectures. They spoke of Donald Wilson and Harold George as if they were contemporaries. They knew them. I was struck, though, by one difference. A number of the historians I met with were themselves former Air Force pilots. They'd flown advanced fighter jets and stealth bombers and multi-million-dollar transport planes. So when they talked about air power, they were talking about something tangible, something that exists, that they had personal experience with. But back in the 1930s, the Bomber Mafia were talking about something theoretical, something they hoped would exist. It was a dream.
The short answer to your question is, no, there's nothing on the ramp that can match what they're thinking. They're on crack cocaine. You kind of ask yourself, if you go to a museum, an aviation museum, go down to Pensacola, or go to the Air and Space Museum, or Wright Pat, and look at the planes that are on the field in the early 30s when this idea first comes, and you go, what the hell? How much cocaine are those guys snorting?
That's Richard Muller, historian at the Air University. One of the unexpected pleasures of talking to military historians is their irreverence towards their own institution.
I mean, what is going on? But they are 20th century men, and they are at the front end of this incredible progression in material development and improvement. And there's just this faith that they'll get there. They don't quite know how, they don't quite know where, but that they'll get there. And it's not particularly unreasonable in their own time and place. It's not unreasonable for them to have this kind of faith, but it is really one of the central things that happen inside of this group is a belief in technological progress and material development. And that if they can get the right plane, they go from the B-9 to the B-10 to the B-12 to the B-15 prototype to the B-17 to the B-29 in about 10 years, which is extraordinary.
I worry that I haven't fully explained just how radical, how revolutionary the Bomber Mafia thinking was. So allow me a brief digression. It's from a book I've always loved called The Masks of War by a political scientist named Carl Bilder. Bilder worked for the RAND Corporation, the Santa Monica-based think tank set up after the Second World War to serve as the Pentagon's external research arm. And Bilder argued that you cannot understand how the three main branches of the American military behave and make decisions unless you understand